Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Launch Space on Microsoft Learn TV. My name is Brian Benz. I'm a cloud advocate at Microsoft. And today I'm joined by Abhishek Gupta, who is an engineer at Microsoft. And we're going to be talking about sustainable AI systems. And actually, this is part of a three-part series that we're going to have on sustainable AI. I'll share some details of that towards the end of the session as well. For those of you who are on Learn TV, great, aka.ms/learnTV is the place to share thoughts and ask questions of myself and our guests today. As well, if you're on the Microsoft Developer YouTube channel, welcome. If you want to ask any questions, though, please do jump over to aka.ms/learnTV to ask questions. So we'll get going with this. So the title of the session today, or the title of the episode, is A Roadmap to More Sustainable AI Systems. And Abhishek, I'll let you introduce yourself, and then we'll get going with the with your talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here. As you mentioned, I'm a software engineer at Microsoft. I work in the commercial software engineering group. We work with Microsoft's biggest clients to help them solve their toughest technical challenges. Most of my work focuses on machine learning, which is the future of the world. So I'm always excited, always pumped to be able to, share my thoughts on AI. In addition to that, I'm the founder and principal researcher at the Montreal AI Ethics Institute, which is an international nonprofit research institute with the aim to democratize AI ethics literacy. And I recently started serving as the chair for the standards working group at the Green Software Foundation, which is helping to build standards to bring nuance to how carbon impacts of software are measured, and doing so in a manner that is interoperable and actionable. Right. I always love to, start off with a bit of context because it helps to place all of the ideas and thoughts that I share today into a perspective that'll help you take these ideas, take these insights back, and apply them with that lens. So first and foremost, I'm a practitioner. I think a lot of ideas require trial and error in the field to make sure that they're really applicable and effective. So some of the best lessons I feel come from the field. I'm also a community builder. The genesis of the Montreal AI Ethics Institute came from me starting a community in Montreal way back in 2017 around the topic of AI ethics. One thing that I realized was a really effective way to build meaningful solutions in this space is to work with a diverse community, working with them together because they help to cover our blind spots. And it's also a great opportunity to learn some lessons from others who have solved similar challenges in adjacent fields. And finally, I'm a pragmatist. I think meaningful change requires compromise. Change takes time, and it's important to have consensus in bringing people together and taking appropriate adjustments and making them to incorporate everyone's concerns so that, again, we build a change through consensus in a way that includes everybody's voices.
Absolutely.
So that, so I guess, without further ado, here's sort of what we will cover today. We'll start with talking about the societal and environmental impacts of AI. Then we'll go into the current state of carbon accounting in AI, and we'll wrap it all up with how we can solve some of these issues and what actions you can take to help us get there. So, well, why are we here? For all of you who are tuning in or who are going to be watching this later, AI has a huge carbon impact, and it also has, related societal concerns. I'll give you a few examples as we go deeper into this presentation. But we can make changes to help mitigate some of these issues. And as a starting point, when we're talking about the environmental impacts of AI, we need to have some accounting, some way of measuring what the carbon impacts are, so that that can help us guide our actions. And finally, once you have that in place, there are some things that we can do starting this week, hopefully, or whenever you're listening into this, to put these ideas into action. So this is an infographic that was put together by an artist who runs the website playthink.com. And this was done live during a presentation that we did for some work that I did at the Montreal AI Ethics Institute, talking about eco-socially responsible AI systems. And it was a novel framework that put together the idea of societal impacts of AI with the environmental impacts of AI cohesively together. And of course, there's a lot on the screen. So, I'd love to, field questions on it later, or you can pause it if you're watching it later, take a screen grab and dissect the image. But basically, the idea was that we need to harmonize the societal impacts of AI along with the environmental impacts of AI, because that gives us a more holistic perspective on how AI systems are designed, developed, and deployed in the world, and what impacts they have on us, the humans, for whom we are building these AI systems in the first place. So let's get started with some of the societal and environmental impacts of AI. As a starting point, when we talk about the environmental impacts of AI, to give you a bit of context, large-scale language models like the GPT-3 that was released by OpenAI, these tend to have a very large footprint in terms of not only the money that it costs to train them, associated computing and data infrastructure that's required to build them up and train and deploy them, but subsequently the environmental impacts that they have. And you may or may not be surprised to hear this, but for a lot of these large-scale language models and other large-scale AI systems, the equivalent in terms of carbon footprint can be comparable to several back and forth flights between New York and San Francisco, as an example, which is quite significant if we think about how what these AI systems are built for. There's also a huge disparity when we think about where these AI systems are trained. So to give you an example, if you look at Iowa in the United States and compare that with Quebec in Canada, the difference in the carbon emissions in producing one unit of electricity can be 40x. So Iowa in the United States is 40 times worse in terms of the carbon emissions that are generated to generate one unit of electricity. Switching over and thinking about some of the social inequities that these kind of large-scale models and large-scale AI systems inflict, we exacerbate inequity in terms of access. What does that mean? When we think about the industry, only those who have access to large-scale compute and data infrastructures will be able to build these large systems, these best state-of-the-art systems. And this promotes also exploitative data practices, because we enter the paradigm where we need ever larger data sets just to be able to train these systems to have the benefits that come from deploying such large AI systems. In the research arena, what you see is that only the most well-funded labs can work on some of these competitive models and publish at top-tier conferences. And what that means is that it entrenches these gaps further, in the sense that because they're successful, they're the ones who end up receiving most of the funding and are able to then utilize that to, again, publish, and it enters a cyclical process. And finally, in a more general sense, if we continue to emphasize larger and larger AI systems without thinking about some of these impacts, the environmental impacts, the compute and data infrastructure impacts, it also creates barriers to entry for new startups, for emerging researchers, especially for those folks who are in developing regions of the world where the high infrastructure costs can be quite prohibitive. The power to make change is in our hands, really. And how do we guide our actions so that we can make some of these changes? Well, if you can't measure what's going wrong, you can't fix it. So accounting ends up being an essential diagnostic tool in that sense. And Granted, it's not the complete solution, but it can definitely guide us in making more informed choices on where and how we should make some of these changes. This also includes things like when we run our training for the AI systems, where we run them, and ultimately also assessing what are the benefits that emerge from running these systems and comparing them to the costs, because sometimes the benefits are quite clear, but the costs not as much because we haven't fully invested yet in terms of accounting for the impacts that these AI systems have. And you know, when we're thinking about how we can guide these actions, carbon accounting is one of the first ways that acts as a diagnostic that helps us put these actions into context, that helps us put these ideas into practice. And it's important to first get an understanding then of what the current state of carbon accounting is in AI. It is at a very nascent stage today, and there's quite a bit of work that's ahead of us. And there are quite a few challenges, of course, with anything that's nascent. And the issues that you know, I think are relevant to discuss are data issues and practice issues. To start off, when we're thinking about, well, how do we do carbon accounting? It is the one of the first few issues that pop up are the data issues. And to start off, you know, one of the most important aspects when we want to do this kind of analysis and accounting is that there is a lack of richness in the input data sources today. Some of the data sources are quite static, and especially in places that have renewable energy mixes, having these static tables makes it really hard to get an accurate enough picture in terms of what the carbon impact is, and hence makes it difficult for you to act on them. And these are also the statically published numbers also make it difficult for you to have a real-time action that you can take, because these are perhaps, you know, lagging by weeks, by months, and sometimes they're just yearly figures. And often when we talk about richness, the richness in data sources is only present in places like the United States, in Western Europe, and generally in North America. And in other parts of the world where we don't have this richness, again, actionability of these data sources becomes quite difficult. Then there's also a lack of consensus on measurement methodologies. So there are different pieces of literature that suggest, you know, different ways of measuring carbon emissions, different ways of measuring energy consumption. And you know, these can range from, you know, measuring floating point operations to the direct energy that's drawn from the sockets, if it's a plugged-in device, or from batteries, or, you know, measuring the energy consumed by the screen, etc. And there are many different ways that these measurements are done. And because of a lack of consensus, what ends up happening is that we lose comparability. And each of these approaches, of course, come with their own pros and cons, but none of them at the moment address whether and how each of these approaches are effective in affecting or you know, instigating behavior change on the part of developers and designers. So let's also look at some of the practice issues that exist in this space. And to give you an example, if you're a practitioner like I am, I'm sure you hate, perhaps, or should hate, must hate, or probably hate documentation or exiting your natural workflow when you're writing code to have to go and input information somewhere else, which is why we start to have tools that pull out our inline documentation and make them you know, presentable in an HTML markdown, et cetera, format that makes it pretty to look at later with all the cross references and everything. Similarly, what we're seeing today when it comes to doing accounting, carbon accounting in AI systems, a lot of the tools started in a place where they were web-based. What that means is that you had to actually go out into a different website, enter information about what you know, configuration of a virtual machine you're using, where the data center is located, who is the cloud provider. You know, it could be Azure, it could be AWS, it could be GCP. And then it would spit out some numbers, and then you would have to take those numbers and you know, capture them as a part of your AI lifecycle, basically. And obviously you already see that there's quite a bit of friction there. You have to exit your natural workflow to go and input that information, which is never fun. And what started to happen then now is that we're moving towards code-based tools. And so these code-based tools are basically quite naturally integrated into our workflows. To give you an example, there's this tool called Code Carbon, which integrates inline within your machine learning code to capture some of these essential metrics. And it also now has integration with Common ML, meaning that you have the entire AI lifecycle sort of perspective from an MLOps perspective, if you want to think of it that way, that makes it more practical and more natural. And you know, finally, I think there's this other aspect, which is that this is still perceived as an esoteric practice. So sustainable software engineering, and more specifically, thinking about sustainability in AI systems, is still something that isn't quite practiced you know, as pervasively as it should be. And you know, you get that evidence from a lot of the GitHub repositories for these tools. And even anecdotally, if you speak with practitioners and your colleagues, you'll see that this is still a novel idea. And so there's still quite a bit of work that needs to be done there. So what can we do to solve these issues? What can we do to instigate the change, to enact some of these ideas in practice, so that we can actually start to move towards building more sustainable AI systems? So there are four areas that require work. There's data and research, there's standardization and measurement, there's practice, and there's tooling. So on the data and research front, there are two key ideas that we need to think about. One being better data aggregation and collection. And second is research into methods that can better distribute the carbon impact, as it were, when we're thinking about AI systems. So, you know, we already spoke a little bit about this problem of data and the richness of data, the quality of data that's available. So when we're talking about better data aggregation, currently what we need to move towards is having higher granularity in the data and making it more real time, because that'll lead to more actionable insights and subsequently trigger change. And this is especially true for regions that are outside of North America and Europe, as I said, where this kind of data is more available, more accessible. In other parts of the world, not so much. And we need to push towards making that happen. Perhaps standardization in this context is one part of the problem, but more so, if we start to demand that we want this data and we want to use this data, perhaps it will trigger market forces in terms of, you know, spurring on new startups or government initiatives that make this data available to us. Standardization measurement is something that's important to think about, in the sense that we also want to be able to compare, you know, apples to apples. So when we were talking about some of the metrics that are put out and how it makes it really difficult if people have different ways of measuring the carbon impact, and you as an end consumer, even if you're a developer choosing to pick a cloud provider, choosing to pick a particular platform or a tool, if you can't make equivalent comparisons, your choices are not well informed. And so that's something that we need to start to push towards. And consensus building in this place requires empirical evidence. So we need to try out different methodologies against these, you know, targeting specific architectures and systems, and then seeing what the difference is and understanding what the real carbon impacts are, so that we can pick methodologies that actually align with our goals of achieving sustainable AI systems. There's also this notion of building certifications, and certifications are important because it gives you a third-party verified source of the claims that are made by, again, you know, different cloud providers, tools, platforms, in terms of what their carbon impacts are. So to get a better understanding and to be able to verify those claims, having certification would certainly help. And this is going to be especially useful to folks who are downstream, who are going to be using off-the-shelf systems and who are not developing their own systems, so that they have a verifiable, standardized way of assessing the sustainability of these AI systems. So tooling is quite an important aspect. You know, as practitioners, tools are a huge part of our lives. One of the things where, you know, when we were talking about the lack of nativity in terms of the workflows as it relates to carbon accounting, we need to better map the needs of our practitioners today. So getting an understanding for what is it that triggers us to adopt a tool, and what is it that pushes us to retain and continue to use the tool. And so the movement from web-based to code-based tooling was one step in that direction. But we also need to understand what are the other levers that we can utilize that will trigger this sort of behavior change on the part of consumers, on the part of developers, designers, anybody who is involved in the AI lifecycle. Also, the results that are emitted or that are outputted from these tools need to be actionable. So just saying, you know, that you emitted 25 grams of CO2 equivalent as a part of an application that you built and ran doesn't tell you what you can do to mitigate that or how you can change that. And that's an important aspect, because behavior change is really the key aspect that we want to target when we're trying to build sustainable AI systems. Without that, all of these initiatives, all of these ideas are just theoretical, and they don't actually lead to action. And that's the key aspect here. And so again, you know, more nativity in the tooling, moving towards code-based tooling is a great step that will help us achieve that. And finally, well, we're practitioners, right? So we would love to put these ideas into practice. So how do we go about doing that? As a starting point, these practices, these ideas are still quite esoteric. What that means is that we need to normalize this idea. We need to engage in a degree of evangelism to normalize this practice. And that can start with a few simple actions, like making these as, you know, soft requirements for conference publications at top tier machine learning conferences. So we already saw this trend start off at NeurIPS in 2019, where they introduced broader impact statements, which made it a mandatory part of your submission to talk about the societal impacts of your AI systems. Similarly, having something about the environmental impacts of your AI systems, your research, could be a great step in that direction. It could also be applied to journal submissions, thinking about integrating these ideas into course curricula when AI is taught to students. Finally, you know, having more articles in popular media can be another avenue that just exposes people to the idea that thinking about the environmental impacts of your AI system is actually an important consideration. And it's not just something that's, you know, a niche area or a niche topic. So what can you do next? I mean, all of these challenges and everything that we spoke about seem to be quite big and sprawling. And of course, you know, we chip away at these problems piece by piece, trying to get to a state in the ecosystem where we truly are progressing towards sustainable AI systems. But as I said in the beginning, hopefully there are some things that you can start to take action on this week if you're listening in live, or whenever you're listening in, you know, hopefully the next day, you can start to take some actions on this. The first part or the first thing that you can do is to share these ideas. So start talking to your colleagues and other practitioners in your community about sustainable AI systems, about sustainability in AI. And also clarifying to them this idea that when we're talking about sustainable AI systems, we're talking about not the typical idea that comes to mind when we think about these two things together, which is applying AI to solve climate change problems. Yes, AI has a huge role to play there, but the impact that AI systems in their design, development, training, deployment have, the environmental impact that they have, that's an important consideration, and being cognizant of that, normalizing that is an important part. Second, you can already start to put in place some instrumentation and telemetry to gather data about the potential carbon impact of the applications that you're building, the AI systems that you're building. And there are a whole host of great resources. You'll see a link pop up to that on the show notes page that we have for today's session. There are quite a few good resources there in terms of tools and operating system level tools that help you monitor the carbon emissions of the machine learning jobs that you're running in your cloud platforms, etc. And finally, start thinking about designing your software solutions, your AI systems in a carbon aware and in a carbon efficient manner. And again, there are quite a few resources on the links that are on the show notes page that you can go and visit that will guide you through that process and how you can design solutions that are indeed carbon aware and carbon efficient. So here's what we covered today in a nutshell. We spoke about the societal and environmental impacts of AI. We spoke about the current state of carbon accounting in AI. And we looked at a few ways that we can solve these issues and also a few steps that you can take immediately to get started on your journey towards building more sustainable AI systems. The power to make greener AI systems really is in your hands, and I don't say this lightly. It's our collective duty, it's our collective action that will really move us to an ecosystem where we have greener, more sustainable AI systems. And I strongly encourage you to embark on that journey, to ask questions, as hopefully you will today in our live session, but also you know, reach out to us through our Twitter, our emails. Ask your questions. We're more than happy to help. I really, really believe that it's something that we can all work on together. So here, just to give you a few ongoing initiatives and ways to work with me and my team and the Green Software Foundation as an example. One of the things, if you're more interested in doing a deep dive, looking at some of the tools as it relates to carbon accounting in AI systems, there is an article on the Microsoft Sustainable Software Engineering blog. Again, the link for that is on the show notes page, titled The Current State of Affairs and a Roadmap for Effective Carbon Accounting Tooling in AI that you can take a look at. There's also the Green Software Foundation that I mentioned, which is a nonprofit with a mission to create a trusted ecosystem of people, standards, tooling, and best practices for building green software. As I mentioned, I lead the standards working group where we're trying to build a nuanced approach to carbon measurement. And we're developing a software carbon intensity standard with the goal of making something that's standardized, that's interoperable, that helps you achieve your sustainable software engineering goals. And finally, I'd also like to highlight the State of AI Ethics report that's published by the Montreal AI Ethics Institute. This latest volume, depending on, well, when you're watching this show, if you're watching it live now, was released a few days ago. It has a chapter on AI and environment that tackles both sides of the interpretation of AI and environment, meaning it looks at how AI can be applied to addressing climate change, but also, as we saw in today's session, how we can build sustainable AI systems. And finally, if you ever have any questions beyond today's session, obviously I encourage you to ask questions right now, but if you ever have any questions, you can feel free to send me a quick email. There are other ways to reach me through through my website, but also you can just tweet at me at my Twitter handle. Delighted to have had the opportunity to share my thoughts with you folks today, and looking forward to all the questions that you have.
Hey, great talk. Yeah, I mean, really, you know, for me as an old school sort of software engineer, I'm always wondering what exactly sustainable engineering, sustainable AI means. You know, it's sort of something that that is maybe a little bit of a nebulous term. So that's really, really great. That actually clarifies a lot. So thank you very much for that. I do want to show a couple of things on my screen here. Abhishek was referencing our show page at acams.com/the-launch-space-sustainable-1. You can find that info that he referenced there. Down here, we've got a couple of links and a few other things and some info about the Montreal AI Ethics Institute and a few other places there, including Abhishek's website and some other things. So please do check that out. Now, this is a live broadcast, so if you have any questions, please do ask us at ACAMS/LearnTV. But also, we have the ability to leave comments on this show page, and somebody did leave some comments a while ago. So let's start with these questions, and then we'll take some other questions as they come in. The first one, I guess, is when is your company using, when your company is using cloud services, who's responsible for that carbon footprint? Is it you or the cloud provider who is actually providing the services?
So that's an interesting question, right? And I think it's one of the first struggles that we face when we're trying to think about, well, how do we account for the carbon that we emit? And right. It really has to do with organizational boundaries, which is the approach used by the greenhouse, the GHG protocol. But what's perhaps more interesting, and it's something that we've been discussing at the Green Software Foundation, is to think of the scope and the boundary of the product or the software that you're building rather than the organization. So the way the question is phrased here, our viewer is asking whether it's an organizational thing, whether it would be isolated to just the cloud provider or them. I think when we think about it in the sense it's really emissions that are emerging by you developing and deploying an application and the choices that you are making. So it's a consequentialist approach rather than an attributional approach. An attributional approach would be where we would quite squarely attribute the carbon emissions to organization X, Y, and Z, versus being consequentialist in the sense saying that by developing this application, by deploying this application, by having users make queries against it or deliver some sort of service, it has marginal emissions as a part of that. And so really thinking about that makes it a lot more concrete and also makes it more actionable in terms of trying to reduce your carbon footprint rather than just thinking about what is the energy mix that's coming into the data center. Of course, that's a huge part of it, but what are the actions that you as a developer can take come from this consequentialist approach and thinking about the scope or the boundary of your product or service that you're building?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, really, it is a collaborative process, right? A collaborative approach that you need to take, really. You decide what services you're going to have as a customer, and those services should be sustainable or at least minimal. And then the company itself, I got to say, in terms of having the cloud in general, you know, when you compare that to on-prem data centers or co-location services or things like that, you're already sort of ahead of the game because you're working with a shared environment, right? You're not working with independent cooling systems and independent, you don't have to have those redundant systems for a million different customers. You can have all of that combined and shared inside one cloud platform, one cloud data center. It's definitely, so you're sort of already ahead of the game, in my opinion.
Oh, no, absolutely, Brian. And I think, you know, an important thing to think about there is that, you know, data centers are optimized for all of these things, right? So they take on that expertise that one would require to engineer those solutions away from you. So they abstract it away from you. As an example, our Azure sustainability page actually talks about a lot of the initiatives and efforts that we have going on in terms of how we take these things into account, how we structure our cooling, what are our power purchase agreements, what are the energy mixes going into our data centers, and other optimizations that we've put in place.
Sure. I'm showing that on my screen now. I've got the sustainability. If you just search on Azure sustainability, you'll find this page, and part of the page is what I'm showing now. Some articles here on Abhishek's article on current state of affairs and roadmap for effective carbon accounting tooling in AI. So that kind of thing is out there, and it's already prepared for you and ready to go. So that's great. Yeah. The next one. So there was another question there. The question is more about metrics. What metrics should be used to report carbon footprints if it's not in your current location or your current country? How long is a piece of string? But I'll let you take the question. Sorry.
Sorry, you're reading the second question there in terms of.
What about if those services are executing not in the country that your company is in? What kind of metrics should you use to report the carbon footprint? I know you talked a little generally about metrics during your talk, but maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that. Sort of reporting carbon footprints, what would be sort of the standards maybe in Europe versus US or Asia and things like that? Or should you always have sort of a compatible version of that metric?
I have a bit of a... I wouldn't say bias, but a preference towards standardized measurement methodologies and interoperability and comparability in metrics. So as much as possible, if we can harmonize and have translations for those metrics, that is the preferred way to go. I don't know if they're asking about specific units or perhaps, but the standard way to do that is in terms of grams or kilograms of CO2 equivalents, and that really is. What is the equivalent amount of CO2 that would be emitted in terms of whenever the units of electricity are consumed as a part of their generation, what was emitted? And when we're thinking about these metrics, I think the other important thing is making sure that you're measuring the right parts of your application. So it's not just about checking off some boxes that help you meet the requirements mandated by law. I think perhaps that's what law metrics is about. But it's also really trying to follow this in spirit rather than just the letter. A great example of that is Goodhart's law, right? Where you have this metric and you try to game it just in the interest of achieving that metric, but then you forget the spirit behind it. And I think for anybody who's interested in sustainable software engineering writ large, it's really more so about the spirit than the letter. So metrics are, one part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when the numbers aren't really established, you can always you can always get your number to where you want it to be, right? But I 100% agree. I mean, it's the spirit of the sustainability concept versus the actual number, the letter of the law, to paraphrase. Absolutely. And then the last question was, I think this is mostly answered overall by this session, but how could your company be green if it's using AI systems? So that pretty much is covered by this session. And there's going to be two other sessions that we have in September and October that'll cover this as well. So I don't know if you want to elaborate on that, or we can move to some other questions too.
Yeah, I mean, if there are other questions as well, I think we sort of fairly covered this during the session.
Yeah, I think it's just the overall session topic. Panzan, I hope that answered your question. So we'll move on to some others. So what happens when data centers are running 100% on renewable energy all the time? Is that basically something that you need to calculate in your carbon footprint?
Right. And that's always an interesting question in the sense that, one might think that, if the data center is running on 100% renewable energy, well, does it matter? I mean, we should use as much of it as possible because, nothing's really making an impact, right? And the truth is, honestly, a bit more complicated in the sense that even when you have a data center that's running 100% on renewable energy, it's pulling in renewable energy from the grid. So the entire grid is interconnected, of course. And what that means is that if any time, demand, for example, peaks elsewhere in the grid, if you have, taken up some portion of that renewable energy, if you go beyond that where you need more energy that needs to be consumed, the default way to ramp up energy production is through what are called peaker plants. And peaker plants are typically coal-fired or gas-fired plants because they're quite quick to ramp up and ramp down compared to things like well, wind and solar, which are, well, they're dependent on the whims of nature. If the wind's blowing, you got energy. If it's not, well, too bad, unless you have batteries to store it. But of course, when we're talking about a data center, you don't have batteries that store that sort of energy. So, you know, I guess to answer that question, we should always still design for carbon efficiency and carbon awareness in the sense that minimizing your carbon footprint, even when you have a data center running on 100% renewable energy, is still a very, very important consideration and doesn't absolve you from having to think about it just because it's on renewable energy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other thing I can think of, I actually happen to live in Las Vegas out here in the middle of the desert. And this kind of thing comes up all the time in normal life here. And that's that, even though the energy that you're consuming, we have these amazing, huge solar panel arrays outside of town. I mean, you drive literally for miles and they're still going. They're still out there. But even so, you still have to conserve energy in the sense that when there are peak times, it draws from other sources. And not only that, but the output, right? So the output of the, there is an impact in terms of the environments when the output goes, you know, the heat that gets generated, the everything that sort of comes out of that, right? The wear and tear on the service and the batteries and everything like that has to be maintained. So as much as you can use sustainable practices and keep things economical, I guess, it's a great idea to do that anyway, even if you're running on carbon neutral platforms. So yeah, absolutely. You gotta consider the outputs as well, I think. The other question. So what about the size of a carbon impact of data centers? Is it, you know, big compared to other industries, other industry activity that's out there? Do you have sort of some relative comparisons?
Yeah, I mean, you know, data center consumption of energy is just consistently going up over time, right? And it does end up being a significant chunk of emissions. I forget the exact numbers, but I believe it's comparable to the aviation industry or even more. But don't quote me on that. We're live here. This is not a real show, so I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it is sizable. Right. And one of the things that's also interesting and, you know, perhaps as a follow on that usually gets asked as well, how big is AI as a chunk of data center operations? Because data centers are, of course, used to run non-AI products and services as well. And it's that share has also been going up, and that share has been going up quite rapidly in the sense that the intensity that's required, the computational intensity of AI systems is just so high that every time we choose to implement and deploy AI solutions, it's much more compute intensive compared to traditional software, which means that we're over time just increasing the share of AI jobs, be that inference or training, as a part of the data center, compute consumption, and data centers itself as a whole, not talking about purchase of renewable energy credits and other sort of market measures that are used to offset some of these carbon emissions, they're still quite a significant chunk of the sort of global output of carbon emissions.
Sure, absolutely. What about, you know, when you talk about carbon emissions specifically, how accurate is the impact measurements that we have from systems now? Are they, what would be the accuracy, would you estimate?
So the accuracy actually ends up varying quite a bit, right? And in fact, the link that we had showed, a few minutes ago on the Azure, the Sustainable Software Engineering blog actually has a few articles that point out the wide variability that you get, for example, when trying to measure how much energy is being consumed by a screen, right? Yeah. So your phone screen, your laptop screen, et cetera. How much energy is being consumed by your CPU, by the GPU? And all of these measurements still have quite a degree of variability, especially when it comes to how we go about measuring them, what are the tooling and pieces of software that are layered on top of that tooling to gather those metrics, right? And when it comes to, well, what is the degree of accuracy? To me, it's more important that we get the right directionality in terms of these metrics. So much more so than saying, hey, we're down to, you know, 1% of error in terms of what the actual energy consumption was. Even if you're within 20%, and I'm making these numbers as we go along, but even if you're within 20%, if it triggers you to take an action towards becoming more sustainable, so that directionality, that is more important than being able to arrive at the most precise estimate and then, you know, putting your hands up and saying, oh, great, we did a great job with measurement. Job done, let's go home, right? And not taking any action. So it's more important that any and all data that we get or that we gather is presented in an actionable way. So the accuracy, I guess, in that sense is not that much of an issue. And this is to contrast with the notion of granularity that I spoke about before when we're doing this sort of data gathering. The granularity actually helps you be actionable, right? Helps you be more real time versus saying that, oh, you know, you just had 1% error. You had a 15% error, 20% error. Sure. You know, as long as we're able to act on it, I think that's the more important aspect.
Absolutely. It's good to establish a baseline using these metrics and then try and measure how you're doing. Are you going up? Are you going down? Absolutely. That's a great way to go. In terms of how do we actually influence change in this area? Are regulations the way to go, or is it more personal responsibility? Or what's your opinion on where we should go with future accountability?
Well, I think it starts with personal responsibility because that's the easiest. That's the first step. That's the step that you can take today, tomorrow, next week, right? Mm-hmm. Regulation is a much slower burn, but it's also quite effective in the sense that it, for those actors who don't want to act on this. So Microsoft's, of course, been fantastic in terms of being quite forward with our approaches to sustainability, sharing our findings, sharing our learnings, as we're doing today itself, as you know, one initiative. But for other actors who are perhaps not as incentivized or for whom this is not the top priority, that's also another aspect. It's perhaps not ill intention, but it's just not a top priority. Regulation makes that mandatory and really pushes everybody towards that direction. And one of the things that I, you know, caution about when talking about regulation is that we need to be careful in terms of regulating for the right things and you know, articulating the right things that need to be measured. And this comes from the fact that, you know, when we're talking about the GHG protocol as an example in terms of how we assess carbon, and when we start to apply that to software, we start to see that there are a lot of problems, right?
What's the GHG protocol? Sorry.
The GHG protocol, so the greenhouse gases protocol, that's the standard for measuring the carbon impacts. And so that's applied to, you know, literally everything when we talk about the UN Sustainable Development Goals relating to environment. But you know, if we come back and think about what is the degree of applicability of the GHG protocol to software, it starts to run into a lot of issues because of the way it considers, you know, attributing these carbon emissions to a particular organization. And we spoke about this, you know, a little while ago, where we talked about the scope and the sort of boundaries for how, you know, software is, software doesn't just reside within, you know, within an organization, right? I mean, it can cut across. In fact, just a few hours ago in a conversation at the Green Software Foundation, someone brought up a very interesting stat that the total carbon emissions, if we thought about Windows, is actually larger than all of the carbon emissions from Microsoft.
Huh. Yeah, makes sense. Millions of laptops. Yeah.
Just Windows everywhere, right? Yeah. And but then that shows you, well, if we were to apply the GHG to this, it makes it incredibly difficult to think about, well, how should we, you know, who should we attribute it to? Who's responsible for making the change? And instead thinking about the consequentialist approach starts to make it, you know, a little more actionable for who can act on that information and what kind of change they can enact. And so, you know, to come back to your question then, when we're talking about regulation, I think it's important that we have first a meaningful and adequate understanding of what the real challenges in the field are and what's actually required to create meaningful change before, you know, sort of jumping ahead and trying to regulate stuff, because you can either end up under-regulating, over-regulating, or regulating the wrong thing. And that's always a problem. So,
right. Great. Well, just to remind everyone, this is a live broadcast. If you want to join us, ask any questions, share any comments, aka.ms/learnTV is where you go. And happy to take your questions and comments on the air. One other question I have for you, how do we split up responsibility between developers and platform owners? So that old dev and, dev and ops team, how do you split up the responsibility between the dev team and the ops team for who should be responsible for what part of sustainability initiatives?
So that's an interesting question in the sense that I think responsibility lies on all the stakeholders who are part of that life cycle, right? And and what I mean by that is, so let's say we talk about Azure, right? Let's talk about Azure ML Studio as an example, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about that as a platform where other developers can come in, build their, you know, AI applications, do, you know, whatever they got to do with it, the developer's choice or the developer's responsibility is in being smart about picking the right solution within the suite of the Azure ecosystem. So maybe you're better off picking one of our cognitive services, which, you know, have pre-trained models. There, you know, you don't have to train your model from scratch and you get pretty good accuracy for whatever task that you're trying to work on. Or maybe you're building a custom solution, in which case you do need Azure ML Studio or some other custom offering. So that's on the part of the developer. The other side of the coin is, well, the folks who are designing these suite of services on the platform itself. So what are the optimizations that we can create in there? For example, for some of our pre-trained services, maybe there are common queries that those pre-trained services get that we can cache so that you don't have to run inference again and again, or you don't have to train models again and again. And so those are the kind of, I think, splits between responsibilities that we can have.
Absolutely. Yeah. What about other companies? What are they doing in terms of implementing things like this?
So there's quite a bit of work going around, right? For example, our friends over at Google, they've got some work going on in terms of smart job scheduling across their entire set of data centers, and they published that paper recently, where they think about the carbon intensity in different regions, and then they schedule and dispatch jobs based on what would be the most appropriate or green region to deploy that job in terms of the compute that it would consume. Sure. You also have organizations like ThoughtWorks who are building generic tooling that helps capture some of these metrics from cloud providers like AWS, GCP, Azure, and compute carbon impact from them. We also have other organizations like BCG that partnered with Mila, so Yoshua Bengio's lab in Montreal, to build Code Carbon, which was one of the tools that I mentioned in terms of doing inline carbon accounting as a part of your AI lifecycle. So you have various organizations that are coming at these problems from different angles. And I think, you know, as I said towards the end of my presentation, the power really is in our hands. The power is in our collective action. So the more organizations we have looking at this, the more creativity we apply to solving these challenges, the better it is.
Cool. Great. And, you know, the impact is self-evident there. Karen just asked a question. What can consumers look for to support sustainability through purchasing decisions? Like, how could they make better decisions that would support sustainability?
We got to walk the talk, right? In the sense of, as consumers, I think our dollars are king in terms of shaping the market, in terms of guiding the market. So if you, let's say, you know, we take the example of cloud providers. So if you as a consumer, and in this case, a consumer being the developer, chooses one cloud platform consistently over the other because of their sustainability initiatives, it is a strong indicator to the other cloud platforms to pull up their socks and get into the game and start implementing sustainability. So as consumers, I think really the first step is asking questions, asking the hard questions about what, you know, what is the carbon impact of the device that you're purchasing, right? So if you're purchasing a Surface Book from Microsoft, ask us what is the carbon impact of that. If you're consuming services from Azure, ask us what is the carbon impact of that. And as you do that, you become a savvy, well-informed consumer, and hopefully you spread that awareness with your colleagues, your community, towards leading everybody to make some of those you know, smarter decisions when it comes to sustainable software, but also any sustainable product.
Right. There's one thing I wanted to show. That was great. Thank you, Karen, for your question, by the way. Hope that covers it. I did want to say one thing. If we show my screen right now, I'll show you on the Azure Sustainability website. So if you just search for Azure Sustainability, it's a long link. You can click on this sustainability calculator here, and it'll give you some details on what you do to determine your impact and how you can actually take actions as well. So that's kind of a cool thing related to that question. So definitely something you can look into as well. Yeah. Other than that, you know, when we're actually putting together these initiatives, to what extent are climate subject matter experts involved at Microsoft and elsewhere as well?
So at Microsoft, we're blessed to have quite a few really, really knowledgeable people. I mean, I learn every day from our colleagues in terms of what really matters when we're trying to measure carbon impact and how we should go about doing it. What are the pros and cons, which I think, you know, as I was saying, is quite important when we're thinking about even, you know, crafting standards, thinking about regulations. But for the most part, today, what we, you know, see in the state of the ecosystem is that you know, some of the work happens in isolation, and once that work has been, you know, developed, built, we start and go and consult the subject matter experts, so as to say, asking them questions once we build something. Instead, and this is, you know, I guess a problem with many, many domains, having those subject matter experts sit with you day one as you're thinking, conceiving the solution, as you're conceiving metrics, as you're conceiving tooling, standards, whatever, that will give you the edge. That will make you really effective. And I think that's what we need to do, is to you know, be open in asking questions, be humble in asking questions. You know, I'm a software engineer. I, you know, write machine learning code. I educate myself about sustainability. I am by no means an expert. So I always look to, you know, my generous colleagues in, you know, asking questions, and they're quite generous with their time in answering my questions. So don't hesitate to ask questions and get involved with subject matter experts as early as possible.
Awesome. Well, that was my question. I was going to ask you, you know, what you've done to implement these and how it impacts your work life and your home life even. So I think we can leave it there. I think we're going to wrap up right there. Thanks to everyone online who shared their questions. And thanks to Abhishek. It was great coverage. You know, I always, it's one of those new things that I think everyone needs to know about. And we're going to actually have two more sessions in September and October. If you watch the website that we have for the show, aka.ms/thelaunchspace, you'll get more information about those shows as we put together the details and publish them. But we are having one September 23rd and October 19th, I believe, as well. The next one is Green Software Engineering with Bill Johnston and Scott Chamberlain. Here at Microsoft as well. So that's going to be a little bit more detail. And then we'll have another one in October as well that'll cover some more sustainability topics. So thanks again, Abhishek. Great show. And if you do have any more questions, please go to our show page, aka.ms/ the Launch Space Sustainable One, where we have Abhishek's contact info and all the details that we've shared in the show today. So thank you very much.